Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, December 22nd. My name is Magus Thiebald. Joining me in the studio here is
Peter R.H.
And we've got a good show for you lined up today. Our last live one of the season, 2025. And so we have interesting story from friends in Nanaimo about land guardians looking out for the land from the Susquehannock First Nation. We have a report about bus rapid transit expansion in Burnaby Heights, which you'd think would be seen as a good thing, but it's actually quite controversial and is running into a lot of opposition from local merchants. Denny Nesvadarani has a report about that. We're going to talk a bit about the new controversy today about involving CBS News and 60 Minutes and the pulling of a story there. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about Denise Rancourt, who used to teach physics at the University of Ottawa. I'm going to be doing a bit of controversials with him.
Great. We're also going to talk a bit about avalanche safety and a new study from SFU that says a lot of people heading out there don't have the knowledge they need to protect themselves. So that'll be coming up later. And some good music and lots more stuff. So let's get right into it. Snookmowoc First Nation has created a program of land guardians taking local youth and putting them in charge of looking after the land within their territories. This is a report from Lauren McKenzie at our friends at CHLY Radio in Nanaimo.
This is a CHLY News update. Combining his work with cultural practice has always been important for Robert Phillips. So when the opportunity to connect with community and grow his knowledge of the land came up, he jumped at the chance to become a land guardian. As a goal to monitor and protect land-based ecosystems, this new Sinamuk First Nations Land Guardian program works to keep the traditional lands of the nation flourishing for future generations. The program is part of the Sinamuk's Land and Resource Division, where Wolfgang Schinefuss is the director of lands. The program started at the beginning of November of this year, and Phillips was one of two people hired as land resource technicians, also known as land guardians. Schinefuss and Phillips came down to the CHY studio to talk about the new program. Phillips says right now the program is similar to the Sinamuk Marine Division, which works on the marine environment while supporting food security and protecting sites that are culturally important or sacred.
We're just looking to kind of copy that with our lands team and expand and explore and start sending people out and just kind of like learning where we come from and learning our stories and reintroducing our people back into the mountains and reintroducing ourselves back into the lands.
Phillips says a large part of their work will be reintroducing people back to the land.
I guess they've always told us that we live in two worlds, right? So that we've had a big disconnection in between us and the lands, and we're starting to see that now in the next generation here where we're losing that connection. So with the program, we're just kind of trying to spark an interest into the community, right? Like,
another job of the land guardians is to monitor deer and elk populations to make sure they're not being overhunted in the traditional territory. The land guardians are currently focusing their work on the Nanaimo Lakes and the Nanaimo Rivershed area. Schinefuss says the program has a three-pillar approach: restoration and stewardship, hunting and wildlife monitoring, and gathering and providing medicinal and non-medicinal resources from the land.
Yeah, there's a concept of thinking 7 generations ahead, and that all starts with the actions of today and yesterday and the days before and what we do in the next few weeks even. The monitoring that the land guardians are out there doing is to promote that longevity, to promote the what our kids, what their kids, and what the next generation of kids are going to be able to provide for themselves through hunting, through subsistence, and kind of identifying the pressures that are abundant right now.
Along with wildlife monitoring, Shunafa says a big part of their job is educating forest users on how to care for the land.
Everyone's living here together right now, but we're not all treating the land with the respect that we're trying to promote, and that is one of the big things that we're out there seeking to do. So we're educating general users about, you know, best practices, how they can interact with the nature the best, what they can take, what they can't overtake, and doing those sorts of things are going to be huge for the program moving forward.
After growing up as a hunter, Philip says in this job, he's been able to keep expanding and growing his knowledge while also sharing his wealth and knowledge with his community.
I'm a father of 3, so protecting our natural land resources, you know, animals, traditional medicines, and everything like that goes a long way. I guess it's just something that I live for, I guess, and I've always advocated for, and I've always promoted good ethical harvesting and hunting. And I think that's something that really drew me to the job, is, you know, being able to be that person and being able to help and share and promote all of the information that I've been given.
The Land Guardian program is looking to expand with programs for youth and elders in 2026. Shunafa says he wants this program to be a resource for the community to ask questions, whether it's about hunting, camping, self-sufficiency in the woods, interacting with wildlife, or just reconnecting with the outdoors. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Singer Chris Rea passed away this weekend, announced by his family, at the age of 74. He wasn't that big of a star here in North America. I mean, people knew him, of course. But in the UK, he was huge. I lived there back in the 90s. And it was sort of surprising. For someone coming from North America, it's surprising what a big deal he was for someone that at that time I hadn't even really heard of. In the mid-80s, he had a big Christmas hit, which you, I'm sure you know. It gets played a lot at this time of year. It's called Driving Home from Christmas. Driving Home for Christmas. Driving home for Christmas.
just the same.
Driving Home for Christmas from Chris Rea, 1986. So there's a lot of controversy all of a sudden coming up, starting this weekend, but down in the States in 60 Minutes, which is one of the most vaunted and sort of important sort of news magazine programs in American TV journalism.
It started in 1968, but it didn't have its slot on Sundays at 7 to 8 till about approximately 1973, 74.
And it was there every Sunday night. And for a lot of years, you know, really until we sort of started to see this shift towards streaming, it was often one of the top-rated programs on television, not just news programs, but top-rated.
Yes, it did for a while, yeah.
Through the 80s and the 90s and probably well into the 2000s, perhaps it was always in the top 10, which, you know, seems kind of astonishing these days that a serious, you know, journalistic type news program that's not going toward, not trying to lean into entertainment values, but really into hard journalism was so popular, because it seems that kind of thing isn't. Anyway, the controversy involves a story they were going to do about
the holiday big check event.
Just a little ad there.
No, this is just.
were going to do a story on the prison in El Salvador that a lot of people were, many people who were rounded up in the early stages of the U.S. sort of ICE sweeps against immigrants were sent down there. And it's an incredibly harsh prison down there where people are basically have no rights, and they're often restrained much of the day and don't get to go outside and are basically, you know, it was originally set up as an anti-gang prison.
It contends to be like an actual terrorist unit.
Yeah,
because I had a brief look at it. That's what it says, and a lot of people are sent there not just for terrorism. It's other things.
And so 60 Minutes was doing a report on this prison that also included the fact that a number of people rounded up in the United States in these immigration sweeps had been sent there. Most famously, Abrego Garcia, the case you probably heard of. And it got pulled last night, all of a sudden, before it aired. And part of the reason this is controversial is in October, a new head was installed at CBS News, a woman by the name of Barry Weiss, it was a very controversial appointment because she's not, it ties into the fact that there in earlier this fall, there was the issue that CBS News was going to be bought by another entity, and they had a approval that needed to be provided by the government, which meant that Donald Trump had a say. Donald Trump also sued CBS News over a story involving a Kamala Harris interview.
How it was edited or something.
Yeah. And CBS News settled, you know, even though most people felt that they could have defended themselves, that the edits they made were more than legitimate, you know, they decided to settle the case for $60 million, $16 million, and gave that to Donald Trump because the corporate powers trying to do this merger were worried that he was going to hold them up until he got what he wanted from it. Part of the aftermath of that was that this individual, Barry Weiss, was installed as the new head of CBS News, despite having no real journalism background at all, and her main career being a political operative, conservative political operative. And right away that set off alarm bells among many people that this person was not someone so politically oriented, so politically tied into one side of the political scene in the United States, was now taking over this esteemed journalist organization.
Well, one thing, if I can interject here, did she have a business background? Because that could have been an argument that she knew how to financially run it.
Yeah. I think she did. But I think that's all, you know, I think the idea that someone who, you know, her official title was editor-in-chief, okay, not just, you know, CEO or some other thing, but editor-in-chief, which implies, you know, you could have someone in charge of business operations because you still need to run it as a business.
Right.
But, you know, editor-in-chief. There's a lot into this. You know, if you're not familiar with who this woman is and her background, John Oliver did a pretty good profile of her. I know that John Oliver is a comedian, not... you know, not necessarily a journalist himself, but if you're looking for a sort of all-in-one-place sort of primer on who she is and why this decision was controversial, you could definitely look that up. The episode he does that in is on YouTube. So people are really, you know, it's not just that this show was pulled, you know, or that there's, you know, they're sort of saying, well, maybe we just need to do more stuff. It sort of fits into this environment where people are already a bit alarmed and concerned about, you know, the politicization of not just this news organization, but many of them, and the sort of kind of bias that seems to be creeping into a lot of, you know, different news organizations. Because, you know, one of the issues is not just this one here, this particular story being pulled, 60 Minutes, you know, this insulation, is that so many of the news and media outlets are not simply being, the biggest ones have always, in the U.S. anyway, have always been owned by corporations. That's not changing. But what is changing is they're increasingly owned by small cadres of people or even individuals, you know. The Washington Journal, one of the biggest newspapers, is, you know, is now owned by the guy who owns Amazon. You know, Elon Musk has taken over X. Zuckerberg has always owned, the Meta platforms, but they're individual people controlling these big news entities. Fox News is controlled by Murdoch.
What I want to interject is that for a number of years, especially in the 70s, maybe a bit after that, they weren't expected to make a profit. Your news division was not seen as a profit thing. It was that we are providing it. You're making profit of all the other shows. So maybe CNN was the one that sort of got, you know, you make money by news. Mm-hmm. But there's a 1976 movie Network, which, yeah, I think they even bring it out that you're not... They were a fictional fourth network. Fox TV didn't exist in, yeah, those days. And they sort of bring that out in this fictional thing that, mm-hmm, actually you expect the news division to lose money, but not that much money. So that's sort of one thing that sort of changed, because during the era of Walter Cronkite, which was 1962 to 1981, mm-hmm. I don't think it was seen that the news division as such, or other program, not just the evening news, was expected to make a profit.
Now, yeah, and there was, to a certain extent, seen as sort of the prestige part of the business. You know, you had all the entertainment stuff, the TV shows, the network stuff in the evening. And the news, you know, it wasn't meant to make a profit. It wasn't meant to lose a ton of money, but it was seen as part of the public service aspect. And of course, in those days, you know, TV operated very largely through over-the-air broadcasting. So that they were actually using a public resource to do their business and reach their audience. That started to change with the introduction of cable. But still, I think, you know, yeah, definitely changed with the introduction of cable. And then the introduction of 24-hour news and things like CNN and particularly Fox, where, you know, they started leaning much more into the entertainment side of it, or, you know, the need to be a little bit provocative. You know, Fox really decided they were going to cultivate a specific audience and not worry too much about providing a lot of balance. And that turned out to be quite successful for them.
Well, also, Time magazine, it was Time and Life magazine, 1930s, 40s, and 50s. They had something in the movie theaters every 4 weeks called The March of Time, which was 20 minutes,
yeah,
which was one topic, unlike the newsreels that would do. And they ended in 1951, not because it ceased to be popular, but it cost a lot of money. And they chose that for a number of years. Well, we're losing money on the March of Time, but it's advertising Time magazine. Mm-hmm. And they had a radio show called The March of Time. But news divisions, I think, cost money because you got to do reporting, or you're covering, you have a person in the Middle East or whatever. So, I mean, it is expensive. Mm-hmm. It's not just reading off the teleprompter or whatever. Now, I like to say, I looked a bit, how successful is 60 Minutes still? Well, it gets 8.3 million viewers average. It is...
which is a lot.
It gets the... It is the 12th overall... you know, in the it's number 12 of the overall ratings or network prime time, and it's the second most popular show on CBS. Mm-hmm. So it sort of has stayed its course.
It's still important.
Well, it's also kind of like if it's set in 60 Minutes, then mm-hmm. whether or not that's true. One thing I know it's about 60 Minutes is they always do the heavy piece first, then a middle piece, then a light piece.
Yeah.
Now, I'm old enough to not only remember 60 Minutes with Andy Rooney, but before Andy Rooney, they used to have something called Point Counterpoint.
Uh-huh.
And then they brought in Andy Rooney, who was just like, he talked about how people eat ice cream cones, literally. There is a little, so he, think about Andy Rooney, he was part of the army platoon who liberated the Holocaust of victims, mm-hmm. in 1945, which is when you hear that after seeing so much of his light puff stuff, like it's sort of like a news thing where they say, well, let's get light at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of kind of ironic that he was of the army unit that liberated the concentration camps. But the other, I you know, 60 Minutes, it's your typical establishment thing. The other thing is that they could really, the administration could get them in a corner by this, because if they don't put the piece on, they can't ban the fact that, i.e., you stopped it, And if they don't have any avenue for us to see the piece. Now, I don't think they're going to do that. They may not put it on 60 Minutes, but they're kind of pretty well forced into having it seen in some light, because to say that they've censored this is not...
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that PBS actually censored in 1991. Someone had done... called The Moneylenders. It was about the World Bank, the IMF. And that has yet to be shown in six on PBS. Now, that was sort of low profile. But in 1938, there was a march of time about Nazi Germany. And a lot of the business operatives in the United States didn't want it shown in, mm-hmm. in movie theaters. So it's sort of like this.
Yep. Well, I mean, we'll see where this controversy goes. Like I say, I think the key part of this, you know, I think why this is a big deal, you know, ties into this idea of these institutions, which have been in trouble for a long time, I think, really, you know, turning the corner from something you can rely on to something you have to wonder about, with very political people in control, but also a lot of these organizations being controlled by either individual billionaires or family operations, so that, you know, all these media outlets are, you know, being controlled by a very small group of people, all from the same interest group, which is very rich people. And I think a lot of, you know, and given what else is happening in the United States, it's pretty worrisome. So we'll see where this goes.
Mm.
You're back at towards the end of the show. What are you going to be talking about?
Denise Rancourt used to teach physics at the University of Ottawa. He no longer does. And I met him in 2008 at UBC. He was part of, he was brought by, actually, their variation, Students for a Democratic Society, had some sort of offshoot. Right. And I'm going to be talking a bit about him.
All right. That'll be up at about 10:50 or so.
Yes.
Next up is Bird Note. And then we have a story about the controversy about bus rapid transit through Burnaby Heights.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer, and this is a note I've written to a bird I love. Dear Snowbird, Junco, yes, you with the dark eyes, dark-eyed Junco. Yes, you are a Junco to most, but persistently in my memory, you're a snowbird. My grandmother, Mamatha, would agree, then toss you and all the other sparrows a handful of grits. She'd shower the frosty ground with that crushed to almost dust corn right from the bag. There'd be no butter or melty cheese on top of the heaping hot plate of cooked grits she didn't give you. That steamy meal she'd toss to me. I know it would have been a bit much for you anyway. You're more of an al fresco bird. I still see you scratching for seeds in my South Carolina home now, like you did back then. I know that the warming world makes it harder than ever to claim snow in your name, but you'll always be the sparrow in a tuxedo, little Junco. I'll expect you again when the leaves are past falling and the limbs almost bare. How about we just keep the chilly nickname between us, okay? You melt me, Drew.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. TransLink, the transportation network for Metro Vancouver, had recently been seeking feedback on a public transit expansion that would create a bus rapid transit or BRT route from Metrotown in Burnaby to the North Shore. BRT is a form of bus-based rapid